from the beginning. You know, 18 months, this predominantly Pentecostal group has been meeting together, caring deeply about these issues, and one of the key champions is a guy named Brian Jarrett. Now, Brian grew up in a small town on the Arkansas side of the Mississippi River, and he spent in a conservative Pentecostal home with Pentecostal grandparents. He rebelled. He later just miraculously encountered God in a drunken stupor, actually, and just turned him around and reshaped his life. And so over the years, he's been engaged in ministry and did bachelor's degree from Central Bible College, master's from Oral Roberts University, doctorate from Assemblies of God Theological Seminary, and now is serving as pastor at North Place Church in kind of the northeast quadrant of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Now, he's written books, he's done other things, but the thing I don't want you to miss, first of all, Brian's a megachurch pastor. That's not in his bio, but Brian's a megachurch pastor. But one of the things I like about Brian, first of all, when you hear him, you will understand he has rural in his heart and his accent, and I love that. But second and more importantly is in 2005, they launched a nonprofit by purchasing, I think it's awesome, the Lonesome Dove Ranch. And now at Horse and Cattle Ranch, but also now serves for, they have abused and neglected children, retreats, therapeutic riding, but also the training center for most, particularly for us, the Water Tower Leadership Training Program, which is, don't miss this, for rural pastors and rural churches. So he's actually been putting his financial resources here, his time here, and his passion here. So I want you to hear from, would you join me in welcoming Brian Jarrett?
Well, I'm grateful to Ed and the team for the opportunity to address you today. This has been years in the making, us having conversations in the back corner, feeling like no one else was interested in having this conversation. So for us to be talking about it at this level with this cross-section of the church is a very encouraging thing for us. Now, you'll find out quickly, I'm more of a preacher than I am a presenter, even though I do adjunct work at some of our seminaries and universities. So I don't have a slick PowerPoint slide. I'm just going to kind of tell you a story. I'm going to need your patience because in order to tell the story, I'm going to have to spend an uncomfortable amount of time focusing on my own life and my own story, because this conversation was born out of my upbringing, my life in the context of rural America, which means it's going to be personal, maybe even a little bit painful, but hopefully by the end it will be transformational. What I hope to do is answer the question, why rural? And back up a little bit on some of our conversations. Why will we even be investing, talking rural in the first place? Tina, the One Hope team, and all the researchers that have invested basically answered that question from a numbers perspective a moment ago. And they gave you basically a legitimized scientific research for why rural. But my hope today is to give you more than a scientific perspective, to help you see the rural mandate from a heart perspective. Your mind has been engaged, and we've dialogued at a lot of levels today that engage our intellect, but my heart and my hope is to engage your heart today. As Ed mentioned in the bio, I grew up a small farm in a farm town on the Mississippi River Delta. And in many ways, my life fits the stereotypes of what people think about when they think of Southern rural life. First, we were poor. Now, my family would be offended by the use of that term because there were so many people worse off than we were, and those were the poor people. We were too blessed to be poor, in our opinions, so they prefer to use the word humble. I was raised in a humble environment. We were so humble that I ate off of a wood-burning cook stove till 1990. My grandmother cooked every meal off a wood-burning stove until my sophomore year of high school. I clearly remember having friends come spend the night at my house. My grandfather had taken two abandoned farmhouses, moved them, butted them together, took the wall out in the middle, and made a house for us to live in. There was a kitchen on both ends. That was a cool thing about that house. But I remember being teased at school because I would have friends over naively, and it wasn't until junior high I started realizing that their situations may not have been exactly like mine from some of the side conversations that I picked up on. Rural America's story is my story. Secondly, my family life was extremely dysfunctional. Now, I'm fully aware that dysfunction is the norm and has nothing to do with your geography. But as I aged and looked back on my life from both theological and sociological lenses, I realized that my childhood is an all-too-familiar childhood among the rural poor. I was sexually abused by a relative for many years, and starting at the moment of my earliest memories. At 14, I found out that my father was married to another woman, the same time he was married to my mother, living a lie between both families. And until that moment, my dad would come and go and come and go unexpectedly. And at 14, when the secret got out, he left and never came back. Now, what's interesting is I didn't know this until I was a teenager, and it sent me into a tailspin and all the trouble that I had with addiction and the boredom that comes with growing up in a rural town. You roll hay bales together, you sit on a tailgate, and you get drunk. There's nothing to do. And so what aided that in my life was this dysfunction. Now, oddly enough, my dad, and I found this out later, was an unbelievable preacher, an exceptional preacher, credentialed with the Church of God in Cleveland. I've had people come to me years later that think my dad's life was a waste. So I just want you to know I came to faith through one of your dad's meetings. And he's kind of turned his heart, but I'm serving God faithfully, and it happened this many years ago. My dad was on staff at a church in southern Arkansas, was bivocational. The business took off, flourished, church struggled. He gravitated to where he was affirmed. Eventually excelled in the oil and gas business, walked away from ministry, compromised a lot of decisions that related to faith, became unfaithful to my mother. It led 25 years of unfaithfulness until it culminated in some story that you would see on a daytime talk show. And those things marked my life. As a result, on and off throughout my life, my mom and I lived with my grandparents, and I eventually moved in permanently. And my grandfather was a bivocational pastor of a Pentecostal church from the Holiness tradition. This one was based out of the headquartered in Joplin, Missouri. My grandfather had a profound impact on my life, not only as a father, but his example of work and his ethics and his heart. He is the epitome of a man's man in rural America. The third thing, addiction caused great pain in my extended family. I hope you're aware, if you're here, but meth is an epidemic in rural America. You're not from rural America if you haven't been touched in some way by the challenge of meth. Many of us know someone, and several of us have had our lives torn apart by some type of addiction, and a lot of us in rural America, meth addiction. I grew up surrounded by cousins who were more like my siblings because I lived at Mama and Papa's house. And that's where everybody came. And these cousins were more like my brothers and sisters, my siblings. Last year, I preached one of their funerals. He was 39. He just started getting his life together, but his heart exploded because of the long life of trying to get over addiction. Another lost multiple children to different fathers, to the child welfare system, spent years in and out of prison, is now basically distraught and separated from her immediate family, and she's trying to get her life back together, and we're all sitting there in bated breath wondering after 25 or 30 times, is this the time? Is this just fragile trust? Is it really going to work this time? There are more that have been inundated by this concept of addiction. I know it's not a rural problem only, but if you look at what's going on in rural America, it's something the church in rural America is going to have to address. Rural America's story is my story. Fourth, my church experience, and I would say much of the rural experience, was legalistic, and the church that I grew up in and around was ill-equipped to answer the questions of a rapidly changing culture around it. Now, my church was very aware of its denominational creeds and traditions and programs, but grossly uninformed to the real essence of the gospel. For us, the gospel was a behavioral modification program to get all the outside cleaned up. And we were really good at taking care of the insiders, but failed to engage anyone who was an outsider. We had no concept of a missional focus. And my church, like a lot of churches in the rural context, when forced with the choice of changing and adapting or dying, The church I grew up in chose to become irrelevant and die a slow, agonizing death. And sadly, the story of the church I grew up in is too often the story of the church in rural America. Fifth, we had a limited education. Now, let me say something about our rural stereotypes. In rural America, uneducated is not always synonymous with unintelligent. There are many from the rural tribe that have had little access to formal education but are very intelligent and industrious people. More than one historian has attributed the success of Allied forces in World War II to the farm ingenuity of rural soldiers who were able to keep worn-out equipment running and operating long past its lifespan. Don't let our drawl and our colloquialisms and our backwardness fool you. There are some very intelligent people in the rural tribe that don't have titles by their names. No male in my family ever graduated high school. No male or female in my family ever graduated college. I seem to be the great hope for our family, all of my family, aunts, uncles, grandparents, everybody, are ready to pull their resources to at least get one of us out from under the lion's paw. And if that doesn't ring a bell with you, I've never forgotten it. As a seventh grade kid, we read through short stories written by American author Hamlin Garland. He wrote a series of stories about life in rural America called Main Traveled Roads, and one of those short stories was called Under the Lion's Paw. It was about a sharecropper who lived his life under the inequality of plantation life as a sharecropper. And I remember reading that story as a kid, thinking how similar, even though it was 1891, it described the feelings that I had growing up in the farm life that I was a part of. I had big dreams of coming to Vanderbilt University and studying pre-med, and I had this deep encounter with Jesus. I felt called into the ministry. On one hand, my family was thrilled that I finally got my act together and wanted to do something significant with my life. On the other hand, they were disappointed at the economic implications of what that meant. I'll never forget a particular conversation with my grandfather as I was trying to decide after I'd declared a call to ministry. He was as discouraged as I had ever seen him. The local school board had made a shockingly anti-Christian decision for our little small conservative farm town. My grandfather had tried to rally some of the more influential, more educated pastors from the area's larger churches to address the school board, and nobody showed up that night but him. He was a bivocational Pentecostal pastor of a small church with a third grade education, and the school board politely ignored his inarticulate and unimpressive speech. In the moments that followed our conversation right after that meeting, his voice was riddled with emotions, personal feelings of failure and inadequacy. But those feelings of failure and inadequacy were not caused that evening. They simply culminated that evening. During his entire life, and specifically in front of the school board that night, bivocational translated low social class. Pastor translated a man who couldn't find anything better to do. Small translated small. And Pentecostal basically was synonymous with cult. And to that school board that night, my grandpa was just another poor, uneducated religious nut that needed to be ignored. And while we sat on that front porch in that very emotional moment, his voice was teeming with an emotion. He looked me in the face and he said, "Son, please get an education." And he made sure that I understood the education wasn't necessarily for me. It was for him. It was for my family. It was for the poor everywhere who never had a chance. It was for my little branch of the church that spent much of its existence being looked at with suspicion at best and disdain at worst. And it was for the church at large. Just before he changed the subject, he looked at me and said, and he used this word all the time, affectionately but also in a commanding way, "Boy, never forget where you come from and guard your heart. You need an education, but don't let it ruin you." But he said, "Ruin you. Don't let it ruin you." I made a promise that night. It took me 21 years to keep. A few years ago, I walked the aisle to receive an earned doctorate, mainly because of a conversation that I had with my grandfather as a 17-year-old kid. I was making good on a promise, trying to earn a seat at the table that my grandfather was never invited to. I tried hard to complete the program before he passed, but he died 6 months before I finished. So I waited to be hooded officially until 2 days after the graduation ceremony at a private ceremony held at my grandfather's gravesite with family and close friends. I never set out to be a scholar. I simply longed to be a learned practitioner. I just wanted to keep a promise to my grandfather and by doing so show myself a workman that needeth not be ashamed. Now don't get me wrong, with all that I've said about the negativity of my upbringing and rural life, I loved rural farm life as a boy. I didn't know any better and I wouldn't have wanted it any different. But as I got older, there was a dreamer on the inside of me, this sense of destiny that God had asked me to impact the kingdom and the world in a significant way. And all of those big dreams and destinies conflicted with the smallness and the small-mindedness around me so much so that I began to despise my roots. And we've had conversations in this room as to how there is a stigma negatively about being associated with rural. And when you begin to understand the rural context and you understand why young people have promised get out as fast as they can. We want out from under the lion's paw, away from the dysfunction of small town life and small town church. And I got out. I made it. Got an education, have a great life, great church, a seat of influence, a mega church in the suburbs of a major metropolitan area, regular speaking invitations. But as I approached 40, something was missing. I'd spent a significant period of time at 38, and as I approached 40, asking God how to leverage the sweet spot in the last half of my life. Tina brushed across something a moment ago earlier in the day that I think needs a deeper discussion as it relates to the rural church. She mentioned that there is something in us that wants to go back home. And Ed even made reference and asked, how many of you here come from rural context? And there was an enormous number of hands represented in this room that said they came from the rural context. And so in light of that, let me drill down a little deeper. No one has put into words what I felt as I approached 40. I left it, despised it, wanted to get away from it. But as I started asking God how to leverage the last half of my life, there was this, and maybe it happens to everybody as they start to approach midlife, I don't know. But I started sensing this longing inside of me. And no one has ever put that longing into words better than Frederick Buechner, who wrote a book called The Longing for Home. And he describes this whole concept. It's actually an eternity set in the hearts of man, longing for Eden, a world that we were living in, a world that we weren't intended to live in, and our hearts are longing for the lost Eden that we will one day see in consummation. But for me, I was sensing that longing to go back to a place where life was secure and I wasn't the guy that had all the pressure on his shoulders. The German thinker Heidegger called, it was a German word, we don't have an English word, but there's a German word, Unheimlichkeit, and it just basically means unhomelike, this sense of not being at home in the world, this inconsolable longing. I started feeling that deep sense that we are exiles living in a place, and I needed to get back to what was home, that I live in a world that cannot bear the weight of the deepest desires of my heart. That's the reality. I'm headed to eternity, but there was this sense that I just needed to go back to where I was from. And I don't think I was the only one. I'm not the only one feeling that. As I look around at the rural landscapes of Dallas, I don't know if it's this way in every metropolitan area, but there are people paying $20,000 a weekend to rent barns to have weddings in. They're throwing up hay bales and moving horse and cow manure out of the way and putting up chairs, and people from the city are paying $20,000 to get married in a barn because there's this nostalgic Unheimlichkeit, this nostalgic longing for home to get back in touch with a simpler way of living. The last 2 days, there was a festival of lights outside of Dallas. People paid $35 a head. A couple in my church, one of our staff pastors went. A little lantern with a light that rises up cost $1 on Amazon to buy it. There were outdoor toilets. They parked them in a field. 10,000 people in 2 days came to the festival of lights. All they did was let up lights, sit in a cow pasture, sing Kumbaya. There is this longing in the heart of humanity for what rural life has to offer because we're moving at such a breakneck speed. our hearts are looking for a Sabbath. And the only place we know to go this side of heaven is some pastoral setting somewhere. So we're getting married there. We're letting lanterns go in the middle of cow pastures there because we're homesick. This very idea is so real to my call to rural America. I was sitting in the O'Hare Airport in Chicago on my way to speak at an event in New York. It was in this season right before 40, trying to figure out what to do with my life, and I'd been praying and fasting, but the last thing on my mind while I was sitting in the Admiral's Club at O'Hare was rural America. And as I just sat there, I started sensing, I'm praying and waiting on my next flight, this overwhelming sense to go home. And I asked God, do you want me to resign the suburban church and go back to my little town of 6,000 people in rural Arkansas? Is that what you're saying? And as I prayed through that in the moment and the days after that, that wasn't at all what he was saying. There was this call to go back to my tribe, to keep my seat at the table, to continue the access to resources that I have in this larger church in a metropolitan area. And the only way I know how to call it is Robin Hooding, to take the resources of those who have them in the suburban and metro churches and begin to leverage those resources to make a difference in the tribe where I'm from. Over time, there was this deep sense, and I'd never sensed it like this before, a deep sense of indebtedness and obligation to the leaders from the small churches that gave me my start. For all of the challenges and problems of rural America, some of the greatest vocalists and communicators on the face of the planet have come out of those environments. Because you don't have to be the best. Young leaders and young vocalists get platforms in small rural places that they don't get in megachurches like mine today. And I got a platform at 16 to teach and to communicate. And I started thinking back in this call home to men like J.R. McFarlane and men like Fred Witcher, who gave me a platform at 16 and 17 and this sense of indebtedness that I needed to pay them back. But my grandfather's gone. Brother McFarlane's gone. Brother Witcher's gone. So how can I show gratitude? And I felt like God said, love what they love. Sow where they sowed. And it led to the development of the Water Tower leadership cohort. Over the last several years, we have been calling in leaders from New Hampshire to far out west. Typically, we'll have 20 to 25 leaders who come into the Dallas area. We pay for everything if they can just get to Dallas. We resource them with thousands of dollars of resources in a year-long journey. They come in about every 60 days. We invest in them. We some of them are going to be planters. Some of them are revitalizing. But we have made them a paramount focus of what we do as a church. It started out with just me having a mandate, not trying to obligate my church, just trying to figure how can I give back because I realize I am what I am because of rural America. We have a saying in rural America, it's not original to me, if you see a turtle on a fence post, you know that he didn't get there by himself. And I realize that I'm the turtle on a fence post. And a lot of it has to do with rural America and the people that gave me a shot. And so there's this indebtedness and this obligation. So here's our objective. We'll have some Q&A in a minute. I can answer detailed questions about what it looks like. But our goal when we take these rural leaders through this cohort, we have three goals: to give them respect, relationship, and resourcing. As it relates to respect, we feel God has called us to dignify the rural pastor, to dignify the rural place, to dignify the rural people. Because you won't talk to too many rural pastors until you find out they feel like they are second-class people in a second-class place serving second-class citizens. That's even come up in our conference. It doesn't have to just be bivocational. It can be anybody serving in a rural context. And there desperately has to be people of influence that have a seat at the table who is willing to change the game by changing the language and offer them dignity in the way they relate to them, in the way they talk to them. So we feel called to give them respect by dignifying them as the pastor, dignifying the people they serve and the place where they serve, and then we offer them relationship, creating cohorts of people that are in similar ministry situations to them, giving them access to us as a local church, learning from our successes, our failures, our policy manuals, everything from how to budget, how to be in compliance with governance and tax rules and all of those things, and then giving them access to other people they would not have on their own, leveraging our relationships, calling in favors to invest in them. And third is resourcing both people and printed material. We really felt like God asked us to be their translator because most of the conferences that we attend relate to us, our church. They're for larger churches in suburban settings that are growing, that have large access to resources, both people and finances. And it's not that the principles that are being taught at those conferences are not scalable. It's just that most of those rural leaders leave those conferences more discouraged than when they showed up, because it's so outside the realm of where they are. And so we felt like God has called us to take those principles and scale them. This is what you heard. This is what it looks like for us. This is what it can look like in your setting. Translate so the principles are scalable to their situation. Now, when I originally raised the funds for the first 2 years of the cohort, I did it outside the church. I used relationships outside my local church. But over time, our church people started loving on these rural pastors, and it got embedded in their hearts, and it became a part of the mission strategy of our church. We are a suburban church, and what used to be a very rural city, an urban sprawl, swallowed us. And because of the urbanization, our church is full of people that left their rural towns to move to a larger city to find a job and a better life, but their heart's still back on the farm. They would go back and live there if they could afford to. They're living in the city because they have to, a lot of them, a lot of the people that attend my church. And so there's this nostalgic value of investing in these people that we have labeled our missionaries to the rural tribe, and I think that's important. We've created a new language in our church, and some of us, part of my goal here is to talk about how do you take suburban and metro churches and help them see the rural field as a mission field. And one of the ways we've done that is to create a language that is born out of a new type of missiology. We have phrases that define the culture of our church, defines the way we do global missions in a foreign context, defines the way we engage our community. And within that framework is how we launched rural ministry. We have a couple phrases relevant to many, but two relevant to this conversation. We believe God's called us to forgotten people in forgotten places. And we believe that God has called us to invite the uninvited, invite the estranged to the table. I mean, that one phrase is why we put special needs proms on in the lobby of our church, because all the kids that didn't get invited to the big prom, they have their own prom in the lobby of our church. It's an embodied apologetic. The greatest defense of the Christian faith in the 21st century will not be your ability to argue Josh McDowell and C.S. Lewis's arguments. It will be an incarnational presence in your community, an embodied apologetic, Jesus with skin on. It's one of the things we teach our rural leaders. Find a need in your community and fill it. You don't have to be the best communicator, but if you can live an embodied apologetic in your community and walk in an incarnational presence, you can earn credibility for the cause of the gospel. In a cynical culture, we have to earn our faith the right to be heard by inviting the uninvited and going to forgotten people in forgotten places. And that heart is what has driven our heart for the rural leader and the rural church. We have to, those of us, you're not in this room unless you have some kind of influence somewhere. And those of us that have influence got to speak up for the people that don't have a voice. And we got to change the language. We have to start thinking of rural America tribally. We need a rural missiology, and I'm not smart enough to craft a rural missiology, but I want you to know what it looks like in our particular setting. For us, in our local church, a new rural missiology has changed the way we empower leaders. This is what I find interesting. We give missionaries freedom to contextualize the gospel to a tribal people. We don't expect those people to become American unless we have a horribly flawed missiology. We want them to become Christ followers in their own culture. So we give our missionaries permission. As a matter of fact, we actually empower them with an expectation to change some of the packaging so the gospel is planted in a foreign or a tribal context. When our rural church planners start acting that way, and when our rural leaders that are revitalizing churches start act like that, and they get a little bit edgy for the sake of the gospel, they get shot with friendly fire. Because that's not the way we do it here. If we will start thinking, we've said it a few times today, thinking tribally and missiologically, but do we understand the ramifications of what we're saying? Because if we fully change our language and we fully change the way we're thinking, there's a new freedom that comes to a rural leader to contextualize the gospel in the same way we give the leader to Africa or Papua New Guinea or anywhere else to go to the tribe God has called you to and reach them. Yeah, but Pastor, this is America. Yeah, but Mayberry doesn't exist anymore. And for those of you that are from Canada, Mayberry is a sitcom that, it's on Netflix. Yeah. Listen, every generation is an unreached people group. That means there have been generation after generation that has grown up in rural America that may say they're this or they're that, but is far removed from a legitimate experience with Jesus Christ. We have to reach them. Secondly, a new rural missiology will change the way we resource rural places. Now, I'm not familiar with all of your faith traditions, but my splinter of Christianity is very mission-focused. Our church is part of the Assemblies of God. In 1914, there were a lot of independent churches that pulled their resources for the sake of missions. That's why they came together. And most of our focus for the last 100 years has been on a foreign mission. But when I was in seminary Bible college in the 1990s, we started talking about the 39 major urban centers. And there were a lot of urban ministry initiatives that were launched. And a lot of that is coming into a deeper theology now that Keller is developing this theology of the city. And yet, in the middle of all of that, I'm not saying we forget foreign. I'm not saying we forget the urban centers. Acts 1:8 is not an either-or model. It is a both-and model. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth. And I don't want you to underestimate the resourcing of rural places when I talk about this power of nostalgia. Because I believe there are resources waiting to be invested in a movement that will engage rural America. These people's hearts, that I've got a CEO sitting in a window high-rise who makes bunches of money. His heart daydreams looking out his window about what it was like to be on a tractor. He can't go back there right now because of the season of life that he's in, but he's got family who have disconnected from an irrelevant church in that community, and he is longing to see a life-giving church in that community that will reach his family and his relatives, and he will invest in that liberally because of this power of nostalgia, this umhanlichkeit, this longing for home. If we can paint a viable picture of what a life-giving church in rural America could do. As one man said, there's money in them their heels because people's hearts long for home. I think if we create a new missiology, the larger churches like ours who want to invest in rural America, people look at us like we're crazy, but the more this conversation begins, it legitimizes our investment into a worthwhile place. When we send people, and we do, to the Dakotas and to rural Texas on missions trips, yeah, we send them all over the world. We give a lot of money to global missions, and we send a lot of people on mission trips, but we're sending them to landscape and paint and help serve rural churches and bring credibility to that rural church in that small community. You know what 30 volunteers from a large church in Dallas mean to a church of 30 people when they double their capacity and begin to engage their school system and that local church gets the credit? What would happen if suburban churches started thinking about partnering with their brothers and sisters in rural places? A new rural missiology will change the way we recruit, develop, and send leaders. I can remember as a kid sitting in a traditional mission service, and every time a missionary came through and told another story, I went to the altar because I felt like God called me to Zimbabwe. And then another one would come through going to the Soviet Union, and I felt God called me to the Soviet Union. I answered the call to go to every mission field. Every missionary came through and preached. I just wanted to be God's currency and my life be spent somewhere. Nowhere in my lifetime has anyone ever stood up and challenged me to give my life in a rural context. I'm grateful for the Church Multiplication Network because they have access to create church planting on-ramps in universities and seminaries, and they have graciously allowed me to stand in some of the chapel services and be that voice for rural America. I was recently in Ellendale, North Dakota, the small university there, and all of those kids come from the Dakotas, and they're in that college to get a ticket off the farm. And I stood there to tell them God may be calling them to go back. And they knelt at the altar and they argued with me. And I don't argue with me, argue with God. And they were being torn out. Their hearts are being torn apart to go back to the place that they had left. Somebody needs to challenge them. And you say, Pastor, but nobody's going to. The best and the brightest are not going to go. Listen, I've watched young men and women that could have been doctors or lawyers or anything else hear a word from God and give up everything to go be a missionary in the bush of Africa. You let that same intelligent kid who could have been a doctor, a lawyer, go be a missionary in Africa, and we'll make him a hero. You let that same kid go serve in some rural place and we'll tell them they're wasting their life. Or they're just paying their dues until a better opportunity comes along, because rural is where people go to die. It's where ministries end. It's where they begin, and it's where they retire. Because we haven't changed the language. We have to believe, if this is a movement, providentially, prophetically, however your faith tradition will label it, then the Lord of the harvest is going to speak when given the opportunity in the hearts of young men and women and begin to push them towards the pipelines we create that will equip them to engage rural America. I just have to believe that in God's economy of souls, my lost relatives in rural Arkansas are as important to him as the souls of the lost tribesmen in Africa. I just have to believe that. And I believe somebody is going to be motivated to reach them. There's a cross-cultural ministry, and we've said this. I've watched so many of our pastoral ministry programs, I feel like would be better suited if we were training our rural leaders in a missiological, cross-cultural ministry context than our normal ministry settings. Now, when I started down this path, I had friends and denominational leaders, former professors and others, say, look, Brian, you got to be careful. You can't waste the sweet spot of your life with a rural label. You can't do that. You don't want to be defined in your 40s as rural. And my response to that question, my response to that statement was a question. Can anything good come from Nazareth? John 1:45, Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nathanael said to him, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Philip said to him, come and see. Nathanael was more likely negative to Nazareth for a lot of different reasons, but an obvious reason was rural. The HarperCollins Bible Dictionary describes Nazareth as, quote, an insignificant agricultural village. Jeremy Troxler says this, Nathanael is about to discover that something beautifully, wonderfully, salvifically good did come out of Nazareth. Jesus came out of Nazareth. It was in Nazareth that Jesus was raised. It was in Nazareth that he likely attended a synagogue and recited Torah and learned the words of Scripture. It was in Nazareth that Scripture says Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in divine and human favor. And Lawrence Wood reminds us that all the rest of his life, Jesus would carry the name of his home community with him. On the lips of crowds, demons, and angels, he would be called Jesus of Nazareth. There is a sense in which the greatest gift the world has ever received was the gift of a rural community. And so here I stand today, in some way, the image of what Paul saw in Acts 16, when we teach it, we call it the Macedonian call. But before there was a Macedonian call, there was a Macedonian cry. A man said, please come help us. I don't know what your seat of influence is, what your capacity is, but I feel obligated to spend the next half of my life for the people who don't have a voice, trying to help gain them a seat at the table, for those that are already gone and those here now without a voice. And on behalf of them, I say, please come help us. Rural does matter. I'm going to finish, but I just sense, let me pray just before we Q&A, if I can. Father, I want you, I beg you to do something in our hearts. For 2 years, we've been talking about this with people. For multiple years, we've been doing this kind of on our own. And it's so refreshing to get among people who share hearts and burdens And we realize there are other people with the same heart. But I ask that you would let it go deeper, that you would brand our hearts today with a burden for not only the leaders, but the people in the rural tribe who have rejected church. We don't just need another church, we need a life-giving church. And I pray that you would help us find solutions and give us wisdom and resources beyond our own capabilities. In Jesus' name, amen.